Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's a big year for finches in Ohio, apparently something that author and Birdwatchers Digest editor Bill Thompson III hasn't seen since the winters of 77, 78, 78, 79, according to his 2010 Peterson Field Guide, Identifying and Feeding Birds. Bill is with us today to talk about that and whatever else there is to know about backyard birding in Ohio in the winter. Welcome back to the show, Bill.
Hey, Ann, thanks. Glad to be back.
And listeners, if you have a question or comment for Bill Thompson, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So what were you, like 3 or 4 years old in the late 70s? And how do you even remember the finch invasion?
I wish. You know, that's 1978 was the year that we started Birdwatchers Digest in our house in Marietta, and I was in 10th grade. So I remember all these like bags and bags of sunflower seed going out. We had common red poles and evening grosbeaks and just went through hundreds of pounds of seed. And, you know, the birdwatchers all over the eastern U.S. were just totally pumped about this because it was like the biggest finch invasion anybody could remember. Those were some really bad winters, if you recall.
Well, yeah, what causes the finch invasion?
Well, it's a couple of things. One, the most typical thing is there's a boom and bust cycle with the natural seed crop in the far north. So these winter finches, things like pine siskins and red poles and evening grosbeaks and the red and white winged crossbills, these are birds that all specialize in eating seeds, primarily seeds from conifers. And, you know, so you'll see a crossbill is specially adapted with its bill to pry open really tight pine cones to get the seeds that are inside. And so these birds, if there's a boom cycle in the seed crop in the, you know, pine trees, they also eat, you know, like aspen seeds and maple seeds and things like that. But if there's a boom, they have really good reproductive success the year before. And then if the following year it's drought or too much rain or the natural seed crop kind of crashes, these birds have to come south looking for food. So we haven't seen evening grosbeaks here in Washington County in I think at least 10 or 15 years, and in numbers now invading Ohio from the north of all those species. Everybody's all fired up about it.
So they'll be here for the winter then?
You know, these are all kind of nomadic birds that go where the food is. So
okay,
if you're lucky and you have a nice busy feeding station and you keep it filled, you got a good shot at keeping these birds at least for the next few months. But they do move around. They're kind of like cedar waxwings, if some of your listeners are familiar with those vagabond nomads. They basically go where the food is, and they don't have a set north-south migration the way some of our insect-eating songbirds do.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Bill Thompson. He's editor of Birdwatchers Digest. He's also a prolific author. We're talking about, well, I've got a couple books with me today. It's called Identifying and Feeding Birds, and another one, The Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America. If you have a question or comment for Bill Thompson, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And if you've noticed the finch invasion in your backyard, give us a call and tell us about it. You can also tweet us at WOSU All Sides or check us out on Facebook. So the finch invasion sounds scary, but it's really not.
Well, it might be scary for your budget because, you know, sunflower seed's kind of expensive right now. But those of us who love feeding birds, you know, we don't spare any expense to keep the feeders filled.
And when it comes to the conifer seeds, they're not the only ones. Birds aren't the only ones going for those, are they? I mean, I got some squirrels in my pine trees that...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, the squirrels eat them when they fall to the ground. You know, chipmunks and mice eat them. I mean, the deal is, though, that these birds are sort of specially adapted to forage on the branches and pry the pine cones open to get at the seeds that are tucked inside. So, and, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship with the pines because these birds are eating those seeds and digesting them and then dropping them somewhere else with a little bit of fertilizer to get possibly a new conifer tree growing.
Joyce in Alexandria, you're on the air with Bill Thompson. Welcome, Joyce.
Hi. I have pine siskins just all over the place. They're emptying my finch feeder twice a day.
Yeah, it's been a huge year for siskins. That was really the first wave of the finch invasion. And if you're not familiar with what a pine siskin is, it's about the same size as a goldfinch, and they're often flocking with goldfinches. But pine siskin is a little browner overall and very, very streaky, and they are incredibly pugnacious at your feeder. So they'll really, you know, sort of gape and lunge at other birds to try to keep them off your feeder. They love thistle or Niger seed especially, and that's the tiny little black seed that often comes in a mesh bag.
I had another question.
Uh-huh.
In the spring, I kept insisting that I had a whole bunch of crestless cardinals in my backyard.
Mm-hmm.
Not a crest on a cardinal.
Yeah.
Now I've got all these cardinals, and they've got their crests full up.
Right.
Why?
The crestless ones in the spring were probably birds that had just hatched out that year.
Now,
there are two rounds of weird cardinal head plumage that happen every year here in Ohio. One is when the young birds come out, they don't really have all their feathers grown in. They're not fully in adult plumage. It's probably nature's way of telling other adult cardinals not to be aggressive to these young birds. But they grow those in over the course of the summer. Meanwhile, the adults often, you'll see in June and July, you'll see a bald-headed cardinal with the black skin showing, no feathers at all. And that's usually due to an infestation of feather mites eating away at the feathers on the part of the cardinal's body that it can't preen, which is its own head. So we get a lot of calls here at Birdwatchers Digest. I've got a cardinal that's got a black head. What's wrong with it? Has it got leprosy? You know, but it's just a temporary thing, lasts a few weeks, and then the feathers grow back in.
Well, how many cardinals are naturally crestless? I read somewhere that 10% don't have a crest at all. Is that true?
You know, I've never really heard that. It's a main part of their plumage, and of course they use it in all kinds of communication and courtship and things like that. They can raise and lower it. So there is the possibility that you'll see one that doesn't have its crest raised, but I don't think it's a regular thing that cardinals appear without crests.
Okay.
You know, it's a timing thing, really. It's a seasonal thing.
Okay.
Well,
all right,
thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Gene in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Gene.
Okay, I didn't hear you say the name the first time.
Yep.
Thank you. And I had two questions. I'll take the answers off the air.
Okay.
One is I had heard about a year and a half ago that when large groups of sparrows move into your yard, and actually they've moved into a patch of ivy, they've been there for a long time, and it seems like the birds that we used to see, the robins and bluebirds, mourning doves, did not come to our yard this past summer. That's the first question. And the second is, when I'm driving on the highways, I like to look for red-tailed hawks.
Yeah.
And I noticed just a tremendous decline in the number I've seen this year compared to all the years in the past.
Huh. Okay. So a couple questions there.
Right. Well, on the first one, you know, people's backyards are very cyclical. Any bit of habitat is kind of cyclical in terms of bird populations. And there are a variety of things that can drive a population of birds up or down, having to do with food and weather and changes to the habitat. My guess is a bunch of sparrows in the ivy are not going to keep things like mourning doves and robins away from a yard, as much as something like, you know, maybe there being cats loose in the neighborhood, or maybe there's a Cooper's hawk that's moved in and is, you know, nailing birds at the feeder. Birds are pretty wary about that. They won't keep going back to a feeding station, you know, at least initially after a Cooper's hawk or a sharp-shinned hawk has attacked, or even a cat, you know. Birds, you know, are wary, and they avoid danger when they've had a bad experience. Same thing with bluebirds nesting in a box. You know, if they've lost a brood, they typically don't go right back and start to recycle in that same place. And as for the red-tailed hawks, you know, we did have another little surge of West Nile this year, which about 10 or so years ago had a devastating effect on certain birds, far greater than it did on others. Blue jays, crows, chickadees, titmice, red-tailed hawks all seem to just be hammered by West Nile. That could be part of it. I've had other people tell me they've just seen a superabundance of red tails this year, though. And, of course, this is the time of year when some of the raptors, like the red-tailed hawks, are moving south or moving elsewhere in search of you know, better foraging, better hunting, and others are from the north are moving in. I can't really say I've noticed a decrease in red-tailed hawks. I have noticed a huge boom in red-shouldered hawks, however. They seem to be really adapting well to urban neighborhoods, and we had them nest right out back here behind our offices in Marietta. So I haven't heard anything about West Nile specifically that could have something to do with it, though, but you know, most of the information, anecdotal information I've gotten on hawk populations is red tails are doing pretty well.
When I also look for hawks along the highway. What are the ones that are typically using the big highway lights to perch on?
Yeah, you know, that's typically going to be a red-tailed hawk.
Okay.
That's our common roadside large raptor. You see a big white breast with a kind of a dark belly band going across it. That's typically going to be a red tail there.
Okay.
Although, as we move into winter, we can get other hawks, too.
Matina, you're on the air from Clintonville. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
My husband and I were looking at our backyard this morning about 8 o'clock, and there were about 75 birds landed back there. And they were brown with white dots all over them, except their wings, I think, were solid brown. Do you know what they were?
Probably. This is a flock of birds, you said?
A flock, yeah,
yeah,
about 75.
Yeah, probably European starlings.
Oh, really?
This is the time of year when they are flocked up looking for food and roosting together. And when you said spots, this is also the time of year when the starlings are starting to get the little white spots on their plumage, for which they get their name. You know, starling means little star.
Oh, okay.
And so the little stars on their backs are, that's probably what you were saying. Starling is a, you know, it's a non-native species that.
But I think of them as being black and shiny.
You know, they are, but this time of year they're kind of tan and
changing
into, in the middle of winter, they'll kind of go into that shiny plumage.
Okay, well, I'm glad to know that.
There you go.
Right. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
My guest is Bill Thompson, editor of Birdwatchers Digest. If you have a question or comment for Bill, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can tweet at WOSU All Sides, or check out our Facebook page. Lots of options for communication today. We'll return to this conversation after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and your WOSU Public Media member card benefits are even better with the member card benefit of the month. The benefit for November is Ballet Met. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission for tickets purchased during the month for the December performances of The Nutcracker. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level and receive your member card. Just visit WOSU.org. And join us later today at 1:30 for live coverage of President Obama's news conference. This will be the president's first news conference in 8 months. It's an NPR News special at 1:30 on 89.7 NPR News. 39 degrees with sunshine and a high of 44 today, partly cloudy tonight, a low of 28. Support for 89.7 comes from Meijer, dedicated to fighting against hunger with the Simply Give food pantry program. In addition to customer donations, Meijer will give $1 million to distribute among the many food pantries in our communities this year. Information is available in-store or at Meijer.com. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Bill Thompson III. He's editor of Birdwatchers Digest. And if you have any questions about birds, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Ellen and Berea, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I have a barn in my backyard, and I'm trying to encourage barn swallows, and I haven't had any luck, so I don't know if there's something else I can do. I have every other bird under the sun.
Well, you know, one thing you could try, and first of all, barn swallows love any kind of a barn, but they need to have kind of a surface that they can adhere their nests to. You know, they make their nests out of mud and straw, and they kind of glue them to the side of a barn rafter. They don't do very well in pole barns, which are metal and kind of slippery and hard to glue their nest to. So that's one thing. And the other thing is to keep your barn or your outbuilding where you want them to be. It has to be open so they can come and go, you know, throughout the day. We never get them in our garage because we have to close our garage at night because of, you know, raccoons getting in and eating all our bird seeds. So But another really good thing to do, of course, you know, the barn swallows right now are in, you know, Central America. So you're not going to have any until probably April.
Okay.
So you got a little bit of time to think about this. But another really good way to get swallows to come in, especially barn swallows, save up your eggshells this winter. After you're done, you know, cooking your eggs for breakfast,
okay,
put them in the oven at 350 degrees for 15 minutes or so, just to kill off any bacteria, and then crush them in like a big pickle jar, and so that they're finely, you know, crushed into little fine bits. Scatter some of that on the roof of the garage or on the, you know, on the ground outside the opening into the garage. Barn swallows, when they start their nesting cycle, love that extra calcium. Probably also use it for grit to grind up the insects that they catch. So we get 15, 20 barn swallows every day all summer on the roof of our garage. They've never nested with us because they've got such a great barn right over at our neighbor's farm. But they come to our place for eggshells all the time.
Well, that's great because we have free-laying ducks. And every so often we get a shell that somehow gets broken open. So
there you go.
That's perfect.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks, Ellen.
Mm-hmm, bye.
Bye. And John in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, how are you, Ann?
Fine, thank you.
I have a question for Bill about a large bird I saw out at a farm in Marysville.
Okay.
It's about the size of a red-tailed hawk, but it's white and has maybe some light gray spots on it. I looked it up in a book, and the closest thing I could see was like a gooseneck falcon.
Now, what was it doing when you saw it?
It was perched on a branch. And we walked up close to it, and it took flight. So,
okay.
And then I saw it again yesterday when I was out there again.
And
now,
when
the neighbor, as I heard, had raised falcons out there.
Okay. Well,
so, I don't know.
You know, of course, it could be an escaped falcon from the neighbor, but chances are, I mean, the big large gray raptor that we have commonly in Ohio, especially this time of year, is the male northern harrier. A lot of birders call that bird the gray ghost. It's a beautiful sort of pale gray on the back, kind of white below, and all harriers have a big square white rump patch when they fly. They tend to fly low over the ground, kind of because basically what they're doing is flying right over the habitat, looking and listening for mice. So if this bird kind of soared low over the ground and you noticed that white rump patch, I would guess, being gray, it's probably a male northern harrier. However, it could be just a very pale red-tailed hawk. I know my wife, Julie, was driving up to Columbus a couple weeks ago, and somewhere along the way, around Zanesville, I think she saw a complete albino red-tailed hawk along the road.
Wow.
Stopped and took some pictures. So you never can tell because these, you know, birds can all have wide variety of plumage colorations. But my guess is the common bird here is red tail. That wouldn't look gray to you, probably. Now, if it was a darker gray bird, I would say maybe it was a Cooper's hawk or a sharp-shinned hawk, something like that. But when you said kind of pale gray, the harrier is the one that came to mind.
Spots.
Okay.
With a bealy white.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I haven't heard about any snowy owls this year like we had last year. But I think you'd probably know the difference between a big-headed owl and a small-headed hawk. So.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, John. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you. Thank
Take
you.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We have an email from Sandra, just to go back to that nesting issue, nesting material. She says, I'm interested in providing bird nesting material, and I wondered what to provide and how to provide it. I have been saving dry lint in a mesh fruit bag. Is that useful for birds? And if so, where should I hang it or other material for the birds to get it? You know, I have some cushions from my chair, Bill, that the birds just decided to use the insides of
exactly.
that.
Exactly. You know, we don't encourage dryer lint, because when it gets wet, it holds the moisture. So if a bird is using that, like let's say a bluebird or a chickadee takes that and lines its nest with it, if water gets into that cavity where the bird is nesting, that's not good because it's going to hold the water, and it could, if the weather turns cold, it could really cause some hypothermic kind of issues. What we do encourage, I mean, if you've got a lot of people save their hair clippings when they go to get a haircut and put those out in a mesh bag. We do that with our kids' hair. It's really cool then in this time of year when the leaves are off to go around and find which nests have Liam's hair in them and which nests have Phoebe's hair in them.
Because one's a redhead and one's a blonde.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can tell. But the other thing that is really great is if you have anyone or you have any access to alpaca or llama fiber, that stuff is great. And there's a there are a couple of different sources for that on the internet, and a lot of the wild bird stores will sell these nesting balls with this fiber in it from, you know, that the folks who raise llamas and alpacas for the fiber, they have this extra stuff that they can't sell, and it's amazing. It sheds water, very warm for the birds and the nest cavities. We put one up every year, and the titmice and chickadees go nuts for it.
All right. And I was thinking of that. They were cushions, but they were the mats around our trampoline.
Oh, okay.
And I kept thinking, what are the kids doing to this trampoline?
Exactly.
My gosh, they're ripping it apart. But it was. I finally realized it was the birds.
You know, it used to be people would suggest putting out pieces of string or yarn or thread. And that's okay, but we really recommend that you keep the strands shorter,
mm-hmm.
3 inches or shorter, because longer than that, they can get twisted around a baby. You know, a nestling's legs or wings or neck, and that can have some bad consequences. So short, if you're going to put out string or yarn, make the pieces very, very short.
Randall in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Randall.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Some months ago, I don't know if it was the same guest or not, but I was unable to answer or to respond to a problem expressed by a woman about getting rid of hordes of sparrows.
Mm-hmm.
And so this time I had my phone with me.
Okay.
Someone was just asking about that. We finally, after a couple of years of trying to keep the sparrows from absolutely dominating our feeder, and so the other birds didn't have a chance, I found a thing in a catalog called Magic Halo.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big wire about 36 inches in diameter that you put over the feeder, and it says that the sparrows will not fly under it. I said, yeah, tell me about that. But I bought one of those things. I had to modify my feeder a little to make it work. But I tell you, the sparrows disappeared almost instantly, and we've never seen them again.
And is this the device that has little pieces of fishing line hanging down from it?
It some of them do, yes.
Yeah, and that,
or
that's
wire.
Yeah, that's a deterrent for house sparrows especially, and it seems to have worked.
Yeah, it really did. What's happened now, though, is that the goldfinches took their place. They're not goldfinches, purple finches.
Okay.
The males are very pretty, and we like them.
Mm-hmm.
But now the finches are in dozens and dozens and dozens of them have dominated the feeder now as well. They're not afraid of the magic halo.
Right. It's hard to enforce a complete social structure of sharing at the bird feeder. Birds get in there and they'll eat until they're full. So, you know, the other way to get rid of problem hordes of birds is just to stop feeding for a little while and then start back up and until the problem develops again. But having a lot of birds at a feeder is kind of what a lot of us really enjoy.
Yeah,
so that's a good problem to have.
Thanks, Randall, for the call. We appreciate it.
The magic halo really does work.
All right.
Good.
Well, thanks, Randall.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We all need a magic halo.
Right. If everything in life were so simple.
I wonder if you could keep certain people away from
it. Hey, Vince in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking my call in. Yeah, in my neighborhood in Clintonville, we know that we have a small coyote presence or population. And I've observed over a number of years, there are always signs posted in the neighborhood for missing cats. My question is, is there any research that indicates that coyotes are secret friends of songbirds?
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's a good question.
Now, you know Clintonville's sort of an urban kind of a... Okay.
But it's got that really nice green space right along the river there.
Right.
And, I've actually seen a coyote in Clintonville one time a couple years ago leading a bird walk along the river there. And You know, it is amazing. On our farm in Southeast Ohio, we had a horrible feral cat problem from, you know, barn cats and people dropping them off. And we used to have to take six or seven cats, catch them in a have a heart, and take them to the, you know, Humane Society. And we don't have to do that anymore. I think it's probably because the coyotes are kind of keeping that population down. The coyotes move in about 15 years ago, and they're here to stay.
It's the circle of life.
It
You're
is.
Listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Bill Thompson, the third editor of Birdwatchers Digest. Sean in Johnstown, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a quick question about kestrel hawks. We live out in Johnstown, and you know, we routinely take the kids out for walks and drives looking for these little guys. And this past year, would see six or seven at a time, and then only one or two. And my question is, what do we know about the numbers of these birds? Are they declining? And what could you tell me about their ranges? Do they move around? Do they tend to stay in a local area? And I will hang up and listen for the answer. Thanks.
Yeah, kestrel is our smallest falcon that we have, and the smallest raptor we have here in Ohio. And they are widespread. Their populations are going down, sadly. Couple of reasons for that. One is they're insect eaters, primarily, although they do eat mice and small snakes and things like that, too. But a lot of what they eat is grasshoppers and things like that. With our chemical emphasis on use of chemicals in agriculture, that's had a bad effect on the kestrel populations overall, as has loss of habitat. So, you know, whereas we used to see lots of kestrels along fence lines and power lines in rural farm areas, now that we've gone to a largely no-till farming, that reduces habitat for insects, reduces the viability of living for things like, you know, mice and voles and things like that that kestrels eat. So if they don't have any food, they have to move somewhere else. Now, kestrels do migrate. Some of them will stay around for the winter if the food's abundant. And some of the steps that are being taken, I know that if you look along the highways, oftentimes on the backside of the big green, you know, exit signs, you'll see a box up there with a hole in it. That's a kestrel box. And there's been quite a concerted effort both by the highway department and by private groups, as well as the state, to put up kestrel boxes everywhere. I know the Ohio Ornithological Society, we put up a bunch of kestrel boxes up at the Wilds a few years ago and just built a bunch to be put up in northeastern Ohio. So they need cavities to nest in. It's one of our raptors that nests in a tree, you know, cavity in a tree or in a nest box. And when there's a shortage of nesting places, again, that has a deleterious effect on their populations. But we're hoping to, you know, bring the kestrel populations back up with this nest box program that's going on.
The phone lines are wide open out there if you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. From Lauren on Facebook, she says, I have thistle socks that I had a really hard time keeping filled over the summer because of all the goldfinches and house finches that visited this year, along with song sparrows and a crowned sparrow. Mm-hmm. We live in a fairly new residential area, not a whole lot of wooded areas around. So what would you suggest for attracting these smaller birds like finches or my favorite, chickadees?
Chickadees love sunflower in all forms. They really love black oil sunflower, but they love sunflower hearts even more. So I would feed, if you're in a neighborhood where you don't want a bunch of seed holes around, I would feed sunflower hearts and maybe get a peanut feeder and feed peanuts already out of the shell, unsalted. Chickadees love those too. And we also, in the winter, when the bird's energy needs go up, we feed a suet dough mix, which you know, if you go to our website, birdwatchersdigest.com, and search for suet dough,
mm-hmm.
You can get a recipe to make this. And it's pretty inexpensive to make, and the birds really love it. We feed it in moderation, but it's something that once the birds tune into it, they just keep coming back and back.
Yeah, you have a recipe for it in identifying and feeding birds,
that's right,
too.
Yep. So, yeah, it's basically cornmeal and oats and lard, everybody's favorite ingredient.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, doesn't that sound good?
Mm-hmm. A little bit of flour. It's getting me in the mood for Christmas cookies.
Yes.
Let's see. Bill in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, my question, I work on South High Street here at High End 270, and right now I'm looking at a bald eagle sitting in a tree.
Nice.
And he was just flying around like crazy hunting for fish. And my question is, how many bald eagles are in this area?
Well, I don't know that number right off the top of my head, but I do remember when I was a sophomore in college going with my ornithology class from Miami University up to Lake Erie to see the bald eagle nest.
Right, right.
That would have been about 1982. And now I think we've got several hundred nesting pairs, I'm pretty sure, in Ohio. I know we've got them down here fairly regularly.
There's
the Ohio
one up
River.
By High Banks.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a wonderful comeback story. Once we kind of got some of the chemicals out of the system, the fish were ingesting from the waterways, that really helped the eagles a lot, and their reproductive success has skyrocketed. So whereas it used to be a red letter day, drop everything and run to go see the bald eagle, now it's kind of like, oh, neat, a bald eagle, which is wonderful.
We see them here every day. There's a pair of them for sure. They were both in the tree yesterday.
Yeah.
And I think I've seen four of them at the same time down here. So they're definitely down here by Scioto Down.
I would be willing to bet there's several dozen eagles nesting around the
Columbus. Isn't that something?
Metro area.
It is such a difference. Bill, thanks for your call. I remember driving out to Tuscarawas County or somewhere way out to see an eagle's nest.
Oh, yeah.
To write a story about it back in the day.
Yeah,
it was such a big deal.
It was a huge deal, and now, of course, it's, you know, they're everywhere now.
Art in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Art. Hello, Art.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, Art, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Bill, we have some fences in the yard there, I don't know, half a dozen or so, and now they're all gone, and I just was wondering what might cause that. Do they migrate somewhere?
Yeah, all of our finches, even our resident goldfinches, which typically don't migrate, they roam around. Something may spook them, like a cat or a hawk may spook them from someone's backyard, and they'll move down the road a little bit or a couple miles away. You know, birds are incredibly mobile creatures with those wings that they've got, and that's over time they've that's how they keep their populations healthy, is by not staying in one place and utilizing one food source exclusively. So, and it's especially true of the winter finches that are just here with this eruption year that we're having. You know, siskins and grosbeaks, red poles, crossbills, they'll be someplace for a little while, and they'll seem to be hanging on there, and then they'll be gone. Then they reappear a few days later. I know one of the best places in Columbus to see finches almost every winter is at Green Lawn Cemetery, with its huge variety of trees and seed-bearing trees and things like that. And again, it's not a reliable thing. Someone says, hey, I had some evening grosbeaks in my backyard or at this birding site. You can't guarantee they're going to be there, because they are incredibly mobile creatures. And they wander around wherever the food is. That's where they'll end up eventually.
Okay.
All
well,
right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Art. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. A real quick email from Chris, then we'll get to the calls after a break. Chris writes, on our farm, we have a lot of large old pines. I have noticed both here and around the Seneca County area, many pine trees either in poor shape or dead due to the severe drought. Will this possibly lessen the finch population for the following year for those that depend on pines, or is this part of the reason to expect more at our feeders?
Yeah, the answer is both, really. I mean, the northern finches that I'm talking about today, you know, the pine siskins, red poles, evening grosbeaks, these aren't birds that typically nest in Ohio. Some pine siskins do, but the others are far northern birds up in the boreal forest, where it's pretty much nothing but conifers. And that's really where the boom and bust cycles happen. Down here, when we start losing trees, like, you know, we've lost some of our hemlocks and things like that, it makes it harder for migrants to come through. In the spring, hemlocks are a great place for warblers, because they're so buggy. It's a very buggy tree. And so that typically what you're going to do is, as a tree dies, you kind of watch the cycle of life. The birds stop coming when it no longer has any foliage that's attracting the insects that attracts the birds. So, but then it becomes a wonderful tree for woodpeckers and things like that. So.
I've heard about the hemlocks. What's happening with those?
Well, there's a critter called the woolly adelgid that is basically slowly killing, kind of like the chestnut blight happened and the elm, you know, Dutch elm disease. It's one of those creatures from Asia that's coming in, and it's slowly sucking the life out of our hemlocks. And if you go up in New England, you'll see vast tracts of former, you know, hemlock-dominated forests that are just skeletons now. So we don't really have a treatment that's 100% effective. You can slow it down, but this seems like it's something that's creeping along the hemlocks, not only coming down from New England, but coming, you know, up the Appalachians too.
You're listening to Bill Thompson III. He's editor of Birdwatchers Digest. We'll continue our conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In 2009, Susanna Cahalan was hospitalized following a seizure and increasingly psychotic behavior.
That moment for me is the difference between sanity and insanity, and that moment where kind of my memory goes dark.
On the next Fresh Air, Cahalan talks about the rare immune disorder that was attacking her brain. She's written a new memoir. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thursday night, join WOSU-TV as Prince Charles pays a personal tribute to Her Majesty to mark her 60-year reign. The prince reflects on various public events and private family moments over the past six decades. Watch Royal Memories, Prince Charles's tribute to the Queen. It's Thursday night at 10 on WOSU-TV. And be sure to join us for All Sides tomorrow and take a walk down Columbus's memory lane with the authors of a new history book about about our capital city. And bring your own memories to the conversation. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 until noon here on 89.7 NPR News. Sunshine today, a high of 44 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Thompson III. He's editor of Birdwatchers Digest, author of several books about birds. If you have a question or comment for him, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can call us at 614-292-8513 or check us out on Facebook. Let's see. Mary in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Oh, hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I live on a small farm with a couple horses in Westerville on the east side of the Hoover. I've got a four-acre pasture, and I've been desperately trying to attract purple martins to my purple martin house for about 8 years without success. Wondered if you have any suggestions, Mr. Thompson.
Yeah, I can just make a couple phone calls to get martins to show up there.
Sure.
He knows birds in high places.
I got connections. Yeah. Well, you know, I have the same problem. We've lived at our farm for 20 years. We have great martin houses. We get martins to come by and peek in them every spring, but they never stick around. Couple factors that you have to have. Martins are about the most picky birds there are when it comes to housing, and that's why they're so special and people love them so much. Once they do tune into your housing, you got a really good chance at keeping them. But you have to have a purple martin colony within a mile or two, ideally, or within a few miles. And that's one thing. So you do have that?
Yeah, there are some neighbors have some.
Okay. Second thing is it really, really, really helps to have some water nearby.
I've got a small pond.
Okay.
Lots of mosquitoes and flies.
Oh, good, good. Well, they don't really eat mosquitoes, which is something we can get into in a second. The third thing is you have to have the martin house has to be near enough to your house, like within 100 feet, so the martins feel safe. It also has to be the tallest thing around because they really love to be up high and feel like something's not going to jump down on them from above. And it has to have a clear flight path around it so the martins can come and go without worrying about wires or tree branches or things like that. So wide open space, near your house. If you can, make it the tallest thing. Then there are a couple of other tricks that you can do to bring martins in. One is you can put some purple martin decoys, little plastic fake purple martins, up on top of the house in the early spring, like I'm talking March.
Wow.
Get the houses up there. Get those fake purple martins out there. Then if you're really completely nuts about it and you want to go whole hog, you get yourself a CD player and you play the purple martin male's dawn song before dawn every morning on a timer.
Wow.
It'll be your alarm clock now. And you can play this and that will bring martins in, because the way martins tune in is the males, young males, females are flying, and they, if they hear an adult male doing this chortling, warbling, burbly martin song pre-dawn, a couple hundred feet in the air over the house, they'll think, oh, that must be a good place to nest. Let's, you know, it's like the restaurant with a lot of cars in the parking lot. You know, they swoop down and check out the housing. Then if they see your martin decoys there, they're like, oh, clearly this is an awesome place to nest. And then if there's open space for them to nest in, you know, you got to keep the house sparrows and starlings out. Then that's good. That really, you got a great chance at attracting them.
It's kind of like a busy restaurant.
Right, exactly. They also go for the eggshells. They love the eggshells.
Oh, yeah, I heard that tip. All right, we'll do the eggshells.
Now, the Purple Martin Conservation Organization is a really good outfit. They've got all kinds of advice and forums and things like that. So if you, I think it's purplemartins.org, I believe it is.
All right.
And that's people who are cuckoo just like you and me, who love martins and are desperate to try to get them to nest.
Okay, I'll do all of those things.
Good luck.
Yeah, thanks.
Good luck, Mary.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Let's see. Get to Jerry in Clark County. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. I live in Clark County, western Ohio, adjacent to me. I have my acre and a quarter here, but I'm adjacent to a 48-acre beagle club, which is rarely used, but we used to have a lot of owls here, and I've noticed since the barns were torn down next door that the owls have disappeared, and I'm interested in putting up a box for the owls on my pine tree.
Okay.
What do you think?
Well, you need to have a tree that's bigger, that the trunk is wider than the box, because if you put a big box up on a little sapling, owls for some reason don't like that. Typically, you need it to be up fairly high, ideally facing south, so that it gets the warm afternoon sun, even in the cold, you know, this cold time of year. Those are some of the things that you can do to help encourage owls. You're most likely to get screech owls there if you've got an old building or an old silo nearby, and you can manage to get a box up inside of one of those structures, then you've got a chance at getting barn owls. But of all of our owls here in Ohio, barn owls are the ones that have just plummeted in population. And, of course, they don't spend the winter with us. They go south in the winter typically. So there are only a couple of nesting places that I know of in Ohio for barn owls anymore, and that used to be really the common farmland bird. But similar to the kestrel story we talked about before, changing agricultural practices, loss of habitat, no-till agriculture means basically – believe it or not, small mammals like mice and voles and rats and things like that, they can't survive in our agricultural areas anymore because there's nothing to eat. So that means that...
What is it about no-till that means there's nothing to eat? I'm not really sure I understand.
Well, first of all, the practices, you know, we've got all this super great technology now, both on the in what we're planting and in how we're managing it. So you've got tractors, and you know it pays for a farmer to cut to plow or farm every single square foot. So windrows are gone now because don't need them to keep the soil. So that eliminates a whole bunch of shelter habitat for things like bobwhite, you know, owls, mice, voles, all kinds of stuff. Secondly, when you're doing no-till agriculture, which you know helps reduce erosion and has all kinds of advantages. You're spraying the field with something that doesn't kill what you've planted, but kills everything else. So these weed plants, so-called weed plants, don't get to produce seeds. So there's nothing, there's no seed, no volume of seed in a field or in the substrate that a mouse or a vole or anything like that can survive on. So it's basically becomes kind of sterile. It's good for the plants you're growing. But it's not really good for anything else. So, ironically, when farmers used to plow up something, then there would always be some weeds coming in. You know, when they'd plow up, they'd ignite the old seeds from past seasons. And those things would grow up around the edges of the row crops. And that's where the animals would feed, you know, everything from tiny little things like, white-footed mouse all the way up to, you know, larger things like bobwhite and
which owl box would you suggest?
Well, you know, if you get a screech owl box, I think I'd start there. That'd be the best way to go, and that's smaller and manageable. You know, it's about the same size as a wood duck box, and that you got a real good shot at that.
Thank you very much.
Good luck, Jerry.
Thank you.
John in Ashtabula, are you really calling from Ashtabula? John?
Yes, I am.
Can you hear us on the radio?
Yes, I can.
Isn't that something?
I'm picking you up on TV.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
My problem is basically is trying to detract woodpeckers from, you know, attacking the siding of my house.
Right.
And, you know, I put out fake owls, and that doesn't work. And, you know, I put out suet to keep them there. And there are several trees around the house, you know, that they feed off of. But for some reason, they love to get into my cedar siding.
Yeah.
And, you know, I enjoy watching them, you know, but I just don't enjoy them, you know, tearing up my siding.
Right. Yeah, that's a problem. As you know, we've built our houses in the edge of the woods or in the woods, and we want them to blend in and put up nice, you know, cedar siding. There are a couple reasons why. This time of year, a woodpecker is probably hearing the buzz of electricity in the lines in your house, or maybe they're hearing, you know, your appliances, like that TV you're watching. They're hearing a little bit of the electromagnetic hum from that. That's one thing that one theory that they're thinking, oh, that must be a colony of grubs or ants that are in there excavating. I'm going to dig in here and try and get at them. It's a yummy food source. Second thing is, especially towards spring, woodpeckers are excavating a roost hole or a nest hole, a nesting cavity, and they are looking for a really nice big tree that's soft wood like cedar, and they can excavate a nice nest hole. There are a couple things you can do. You've tried the fake owl. Some people have used rubber snakes to work. Some people have used like a super soaker squirt gun with water in it just to spook the woodpecker away from the site. You can try hanging up tin aluminum pie plates that'll rattle in the wind, or old CDs. There's great use for those old Yanni CDs that you're not listening to anymore. Hang those up there. They flutter and flash and sometimes can spook away the woodpeckers. But the ultimate solution, sadly, if you've got – it's typically one or two birds that are the problem, that have tuned into this as a place to go excavate. You know, if you can't put chicken wire up or sheet metal up to prevent them from digging, some people end up calling the wildlife officer, who will come out and remove the bird, which is a euphemism for basically killing it. So that's not something that I ever want to do or ever want to encourage. However, you get a bird that gets this in his mind to, this is the place I want to create a cavity, and that's sometimes that's the only option, sadly. But I have heard people that have put up a nest box on the exact site where the woodpecker is excavating, filled it chock full with wood chips, not sawdust, actual wood chips. That gives the woodpecker something to excavate, and it gets them fired up, and then they use that as their roost box or nest cavity, and they leave the house alone.
All right, John. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Okay. I got a few more calls I want to get squeeze in here. Glenn in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Thanks. I live right along the river on the Olentangy, and I feed the woodpeckers beef soot a lot, and I've even had pileated woodpeckers come right up to the house. But last year I was having a little trouble finding beef soot in the grocery store, so I took some lard that I'd saved and made a ball and put oiled sunflower seed in it, and they wouldn't touch it. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't come near it, and I just was wondering. You mentioned a while ago you had a recipe for lard, and I just couldn't get them to even come near it.
Well, lard by itself, I don't know that it's attractive enough to birds. You know, the reason that beef suet, which is like the fat that goes around beef kidneys, the reason that's attractive to them is it's got some actual protein in it and gives them a good energy boost. So that fat, when they burn it off, it's a really good energy boost for the birds. However, as we've lost our butchers, you know, a lot of grocery stores get all their meat prepackaged now. The suet, beef suet never makes it to the grocery store. So you really kind of have to look around for it sometimes. So I appreciate how that is. It's happened to our stores here in Marietta, but the recipe that we use basically is lard, peanut butter, cornmeal
old-fashioned oats. We don't encourage putting any seed in it because the seed really gets kind of too slippery and greasy for a bird like a chickadee or somebody to peck it open.
And it says all-purpose flour here,
and,
too.
Yeah, and a little bit of flour. And you mix that up, and you want it to be kind of a crumbly consistency. And, again, we feed that stuff in moderation because we noticed one winter after we'd fed our bluebirds that a couple of our bluebirds started getting what was probably gout in their feet. So we don't want to overdo it.
Oh, yeah, I think Julie talked about that.
She did.
Bill happens to be married to Julie Zickafoos.
Right.
Glenn, thanks for your call. I want to squeeze one more. Philip and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
I have several feeders around my house. And
hi. Are you there, Philip?
Yeah.
Well, for some reason, it keeps getting cut off. So we'll quickly turn to Jeanette in Pickerington.
Hi. Thank you for all the good information. Two questions. First, several years ago, we had an ice storm. I have a feeder that's kind of like a hanging plate. So I went out, cleaned the feeder off, put out black oil sunflower seeds. I had almost no birds there except 12 cardinals. Can you give a reason why these cardinals might turn up en masse?
Well, in winter, cardinals lose their territoriality, a lot of our songbirds do, and they tend to just hang around in loose feeding flocks. It's not like they're roosting right up next to each other at night or anything, but they're not territorial. So whereas in May or June, you might see a pair of cardinals defending your feeder, trying to keep other cardinals out of their territory, you don't see that in the winter. And I know at our feeders here in southeast Ohio, we sometimes have 75 or 80 cardinals at once at our various feeders in front and back of our house. So they are all coming into a good food source. They're territorial. Nature is really reduced. It's sort of a live and let live outlook, I think, that cardinals get in the winter, and a lot of birds feel that way. In the winter, their urge to defend their territory is just not so great.
Jeanette, thanks for your call.
Oh, one more question, if you don't mind,
really quickly.
We've been told to use lard in some of these recipes. Is all beef fat suitable, or is it just lard?
Yeah, it is. All beef fat is suitable. You might have to render it, and I would suggest doing that outside, not inside your house, because you'll smell like McDonald's for a couple of days.
Thank you very
much. Okay. Thanks, Jeanette.
Okay. Bye.
Bill, I have 30 seconds. You've got a smartphone app, right?
Oh, yeah, the Birdwatchers Digest app. Yep.
Okay. So just want to let people know about that, and you also have one for your tablets and
yeah, we have a digital edition for the magazine. It's all at birdwatchersdigest.com /digital, I think it is. You can check out everything there, and people can subscribe to our magazine. We still actually publish a print magazine.
You do, and it is a beaut. Bill Thompson, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a lot of fun.
Hey, always fun, Ann. Thank you so much.
Bill Thompson, he's editor of Bird Watchers Digest. He's written several books, including Identifying and Feeding Birds and also Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America. Thanks to the All Sides staff, brand new producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, production assistants Katie Higgins and Leticia Wiggins and Rose Joe, video production by Rich and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks so much for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.